Hey, and welcome to the 6 Minute Mile podcast. We've been very fortunate to land some world-class guests on our little show, but this week we're particularly thrilled to catch up with one of our all-time heroes, Bill Rogers. He is an OG of the American running boom that exploded in the 70s when Bill won 4 Boston marathons in 6 years and ran in the 1976 Olympics. He was legendary for racking up 170-mile training weeks and still finding time to belly up to the bar at the Elliott Lounge in Boston to unwind with bartender Tommy Leonard, the founder of the Falmouth Road Race. What we didn't realize about Bill was that he was also a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War and was so stressed out during grad school that he quit running and started smoking cigarettes. We delve into the complex mindset of someone who is such a peaceful and generous soul, but also fiercely competitive. We were treated to some top-notch stories about the characters who populated the golden age of American distance running. Enjoy, and we'll see you out there.
Well, I was telling a friend the other day that you won't remember this, but it was a major moment in my life. But I think back the very first BAA half marathon, which might have been 2002, 2003 or so, and I was clipping along. I was in okay shape back then, and I'm like, hey, I'm having a pretty good race. And at mile 10, I look over my left shoulder and Bill Rogers is past me. I'm like, wow, I held off Bill Rogers for 10 miles. And then I think I bumped into you after the race. I said, hey man, what's the real story? I know I wasn't really holding you off for 10 miles. And you said, I don't know if you remember this. You said, you know, I was at the starting line and I saw a guy there wearing sandals, but all with a bib on. I said, hey, what's going on? And the guy said, oh man, you'll never believe this. I forgot my running shoes. And you said to the guy, I think he was a total stranger. You're like, I got an extra, what size are you? You know, size 10, I'll go back to my trunk and get them. So you ran back to your car, the gun goes off. You know, it takes you like an extra 10 minutes to cross the starting line, but you went back, gave these shoes to this random stranger. And I don't know, that story's always stuck in my mind, but do I roughly have that right? Do you remember that day?
You have it totally right. One of my buddies was coming in for that race, the first BAA half marathon, you know, and I had some old training shoes in his car. He had them in the car. I forget what the deal was. We switched shoes, something like that, you know. Yeah. I had an extra pair of shoes, you know, and I said, you know, what the heck? But, you know, those are the types, that's what runners do. That's right. The way we are, you know. Yeah. Unless the guy's going to beat you, and you don't want to help him out too much.
That's right. No, but you're absolutely right. No, it's a competitive sport, but there's a lot of, you know, good humor and supporting your fellow competitors. So
yeah, there's the camaraderie and the competitive side. And I, you know, to me, it's the greatest sport in the world. And I've always felt that way, you know, and I think it's more true than ever before today as the sport has grown, you know, over the years and years and years. And I think it's going to keep going that way. It's going to keep growing. I think it'll get more strength. You know, at the first runner specialty retail store, kind of like the store out in Michigan, you know, with the two brothers
who started the
Hanson brothers. Yes. Yeah. And good guys, and did so much for the sport, you know, with Desi and
absolutely
the young dentist marathoner who was a 2:10 guy. And, but we started a store in 1977, you know, and I was a teacher for a few years before that, for 3.5 years. But in those days, we were all opening running stores, whether you were Jeff Galloway or Frank Schroeder or Don Cardone, you know, and so that's the way it was, because, or Johnny Kelly, the younger Johnny Kelly, because we all wanted to be able to run in the summer, which is when road racing was mainly happening, you know.
Right.
And I think it was that our mentalities were kind of like that. We had this mentality as runners too, that I don't know, we're kind of reaching out kind of people and that sort of thing, you know. But we still have our store. In fact, it's you can reach us at the store at BillRogersRunningCenter.com. You know, if people are interested, I have a book. We all have a book nowadays, you know. It's kind of funny, but
I've read the book. The book is excellent, Marathon Man. And I was poking around on the Bill Rogers Running Center site, and you can order the book there. And I think you've sold a lot of these, right? You've sold tens of thousands of copies of Marathon Man.
I think we've sold about 30,000 copies. It's hard for me to read the printout from the publisher, but it's done pretty good. you know, it's a real nuts and bolts book. I've read a lot of books over the years of all the runners, whether it was Damar or Kelly, or I haven't yet read Dina's book. I want to read Dina's book. You know, I read Meb's book, you know, all Andy Burfoot stuff, Doc Sheehan from way back, you know, and I read everything I can about the sport because I've always been fascinated by everything in the sport.
Yeah.
You know, I read about Zatopek, you know, the great Czech runner,
and right.
Some of the Africans, of course, you know, I read about them, you know, but I think our sport is still changing. And but if any of your listeners would like a copy of the book, I'm glad to sign it for them. That's kind of
what that's great.
These days,
you know? That's really cool. Well, no, because the store, I remember the store in Faneuil Hall, and it really was a gathering point for runners, right? Before there were, you know, maybe as many run clubs or Nike run clubs and that sort of thing. But runners would go and just hang out. And, you know, back then, yes, to find out about when the next running race was coming, you had to go to your shop to see, you know, the brochures tacked to the walls and like, oh, huh, yeah, okay. You know, that's probably where people first learned about Falmouth or something, right? Just by going to the run shop. But,
you know, it's totally true. And we opened our store to be, we call it the Running Center because we wanted it to be a learning place. And also, I didn't want to pay a franchise fee. There were some stores like the Athletic Attic, but they wanted a big fee, like $25,000 or something.
Yeah.
We didn't have a lot of money. It was, you know, my former wife and I got together and put the money together that started. My brother Charlie came in as the manager, our best friend was assistant manager. We were really winging it. And yeah, all of us were like that because we couldn't make a living in those days through using our name so much. I guess we did it in a way. Frank started that with his store in 76, and I opened my store in 77. Jeff Galloway opened Fidipides, I think, even earlier.
I think that's right.
But we wanted it to be to reach out to runners. We would have clinics. We'd have podiatrists come in, Rob Roy, McGregor, who worked for Etonic, you know, and we all did our runs from there. You know, we go over to the Boston College track or out around Jamaica Pond, you know, wherever. And I think all the running stores are pretty much the same, and they serve this great use. And it's sad to see many of them dying off now that, you know, some of the runners are getting their shoes online, and it's kind of a community issue that is also, I think, a little bit at stake because we learn from other runners. You know, I learn from my training partners and coach squires and friends, but because we all need that help, you know, and so I guess, but we're still there. We have an online sort of thing now. And
well, you've got great, I'm a history buff and I love sports history, and you've got some great material in there, some great old photos and old kind of war stories about some races in the past. And it's worth going to the website just to see all that stuff, I think.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. My brother Charlie and his son Andrew really keep it going. I'm terrible with technology. That's why I became a runner. I couldn't do anything else, you know.
That's not true.
You know, I'm just gonna run a lot, you know.
Yeah.
That usually works.
And I want to rewind a little bit. You know, I want to touch on some of the iconic stories of the later years and winning three straight Boston marathons and that sort of thing. But I'd love to hear a little bit about what life was like growing up with these three brothers in New England, and you were athletes in other sports first. And I'd love to hear about how you switched interest in baseball or hockey or something, and how you came to discover running.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what my book Marathon Man is about. And by the way, I did try all the other sports. So did my brother Charlie, our best friend Jason Kehoe. You know, who's in? They're all in the book, and it was really the way the sports world was back in the 60s. I began as a runner in 63 with Charlie and Jason. Cross country was new at Newington High School, just outside of Hartford, Connecticut, where we're from. And it was very exciting because I would, in those days, President Kennedy, of course, was talked about health and fitness, something we have lost our focus on, I believe, as a country.
I agree.
And, but I listened to him, and we all did and in those days. And so we all rode our bikes and that sort of thing as kids, but they had a gym class mile. And I was the fastest kid in the school, the gym class mile, as a 15-year-old sophomore. You know, so they started cross country. We had about five or six of us. There was no girls team then because the backwardness of the International
Olympic Committee. Yeah, that's too bad. Yeah.
They held women back in that regard. And so, but we had fun with the sport. It was just a fun sport. We had a really good coach, Coach Frank O'Rourke. He didn't have us do very much compared to the high school runners of the day. But we also ran track. We had a grass track, 5 laps to the mile. You know, it's
this, I love grass tracks. That's classic. Great.
Yeah, because you don't get injured so much, like from running on the roads too much. So I had a good start, and so did Charlie. Charlie still runs today. Jason is gone. I'm very sad to say, our good buddy, but he had a great life as a runner. And but we had fun with the sport. Then we ran track, you know, and we ran 3 years, and then I got recruited by a fellow named Andy Burfoot, who is a Boston Marathon champion.
Of course,
1968, and I raced against his brother at the Connecticut State meet, and he said, "Would you be interested in checking out Wesleyan University down the road from where I live?" And I said, "Yeah, of course." And so I went to Wesleyan, and there was another guy there named Jeff Galloway.
Unbelievable.
One of our country's greatest coaches. And we needed about another 1,000 Jeff Galloways or something, you know, because he's done such a brilliant job of reaching out to people.
He really has.
A gift. Yeah, he has that gift, you know. And so I became a runner under the tutelage of those guys and the Wesleyan coach. Coach Elmer Swanson, who was a very smart guy because he didn't push us too hard. Okay. He let us explore. You got to find out what distance you're best at and what do you love? What do you really want to go for? And so I started following that kind of a system with Ambie and Jeff. And but for me, I quit running after college because for me, it was a team thing. Your friends.
Yeah.
It's just running with your friends. And it was during a very terrible time for our country, kind of like what we are facing now.
Sure.
A terrible time with the pandemic. Our involvement in the Vietnam War was very, very tough on the American people and Vietnamese people. It was a tough, tough time. And so I moved to Boston for my selective service obligation, conscientious objector. And I worked in a hospital a couple of years, and that was really a learning experience for me and led to my, and I saw the Boston Marathon. I lived right near the finish line, you know, and so.
But at that point, you had slowed down on your running, right? When you moved to Boston, you graduated from college, wasn't a team sport for you anymore, and you kind of hit pause.
You know, I always felt the tragedy of the war. I could see it every day. I knew, you know, either what was going to happen, either I was going to go to jail, like Muhammad Ali, or, you know, something. I don't know what. But I ended up, selective service was changing. Supreme Court said, yes, you're against, you know, I grew up as a Catholic kid and everything. And,
right.
And I read about Gandhi, Martin Luther King, you know, I was a student of Wesleyan when that happened and everything, the tragedy. So this really affected me a lot, you know. And so that's why I didn't know where I was going, what I was going to do. So I went to Boston. They said, yes, you can do this. And I always felt ever since then that everybody should do what Kennedy said. President Kennedy said, you know, what can you do? And we have to find more than maybe just the military. Find what you are good at and commit that to yourself to that, maybe for your country, maybe you're good at business, maybe you're good in law, maybe you're good in art or music. Find what it is. For me, it ended up, I was lucky I found running again. And I was lucky to, you know, by chance, see the Boston Marathon. There was Ambie Burfoot running again and Jeff Galloway. And I had my cigarettes here. I'd become a smoker.
Come on, kind of really?
Depressing time for me.
Yeah.
Well, you're working in a hospital. It's tough seeing people really sick.
Yeah.
And so, but it motivated me. It motivated me. So I joined the Boston Y. And that really, everything started to change then. I had a motorcycle in those days because we were all watching Easy Rider.
Right, Well,
you know, riding our motorcycles. But I really wasn't a motorcycle guy. I'm too mild and meek for that.
All right.
Guy.
Yeah.
But But so I had nothing left. Bad. Yes, I had nothing left. And so you know, I felt good when I was a runner.
Yeah. And so, and then around that time, the Greater Boston Track Club was getting going too, right?
Yes. Yes. I what happened was I ran a 30K race. I built up my fitness in 72. Frank Shorter took the gold medal. We all saw that. We're all inspired by that.
Yeah, that's inspired.
You know, and I was recruited by Jack Semple of the Boston Athletic Association. I ran for the BEA for a year. Ran my first marathon, which was a fiasco and the terrible heat. And I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
No water on the course. And I dropped out, quit running again. But then the Greater Boston Track Club, I heard through the grapevine, somehow or other, this new club's forming. And the problem with the BAA is I didn't have a car. How do you get to the races? Well, with this bigger, newer club, people with cars, you know, you can get to the races. And a fellow named Bob 70, who is actually a Vietnam vet, was one of the co-founders of the Greater Boston Track Club.
Him and Jack. I didn't know that. You always hear Bill Squire's name, but I didn't know Bob was involved.
Squires became our coach.
Okay.
Bob 70, Coach Joan Benoit, helped guide her to her Olympic gold. Was a really sharp dude, and really tough guy too. You know, made it through Vietnam and everything.
Man,
good guy.
Yeah.
But we became good buddies. And Jack McDonald was about a 4-minute runner for Boston College. These were the guys who led the development of Greater Boston. And suddenly, this new club is on the scene, and we started to crank out. You know, and people like Greg Meyer.
Greg, who went on to win a marathon, yeah.
Yeah, he won Boston in 83. I recruited him to join Greater Boston.
Oh,
he came
good.
Out from Michigan, Randy Thomas, about a 404 miler.
Yeah.
211 marathoner. Mike Roach, Olympian in the steeplechase. Pete Fitzinger, Bobby Hodge, Dick Mahoney. We had a slew of people because it was just a slice of America.
Yeah. And Alberto Salazar eventually too, right?
Yeah. Alberto as well, you know. So he lived in Wayland, Mass, right down the road. I knew him when he was 18 years old. You know, he had the eye of the tiger already. He was ferocious. He was tough. Smart. If you ever read his book, you can understand how smart he understood training better than anyone I ever met. Coach Squires was a different kind of figure. Kind of you'd think he was, but he was just as intense as Alberto. You know, he had that fire because Coach Squires was a national level high school miler and went to Notre Dame University, really high level miler at Notre Dame. And so he had that love of the sport. So we can see that in the success of running over the last 20 years, I would say in particular, all this young people who grew up learning more and more about the sport, the science of exercise, and being motivated by these new coaches.
Yeah.
And so they're following the lead of the Squires, you know, and Mebs coach, Bob Larson, you know. Another great book is Bob Larson's book about how he coached the Yamul coach, how he coached Meb.
Oh, good. I'll look that one up.
A really good book.
And did you feel, so when you're running with Greater Boston Track Club, did you feel a little bit of that team magic again?
Oh,
is
yeah.
that part of it? Yeah.
Oh yeah. That's everything. Yeah. That's one reason why the Canes are so good. The Ethiopians. It's absolutely the key. Alberto knew that. Nike knew that. That's why they succeeded. You know, the New York runners up in Arizona, up in Flagstaff, same thing, you know, Northern Arizona. You got to have your teammates.
Yeah.
There's nobody who succeeds on their own. Nobody. I can't think of anyone really who has, you know, the top runners going back over the years, you know, because it's too tough. You can never push yourself as hard as you can with your teammates, you know?
Right, right. And are there, you know, of course, Alberto hit a few bumps in the road at Nike recently, but are there other projects, and the Hansons did their project. I feel as we haven't heard as much recently out of them, but is that part of maybe the dip in American running? Do you feel as if we had more of a team culture and training camps where 20 top folks could get together, would that help American running?
I think a lot of it is that let's take a look. Let's be real. We don't give any media support to cross country for sure.
Right.
Cross country is big worldwide, and we don't give it that much, which is kind of a weak thing, I think. I think it's a sign that we've got to be tougher. I think in the sports world, I think we have a misunderstanding about sports a little bit for me.
Okay.
We put all the money into some sports and nothing to others.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. But I do love how track stood up. Nike stood up for track and field in America.
True.
And for USA track and field. That's what we need. And if we can get the media, the mainstream media, we're doing that in the marathon. You know, we need to do it for cross country as well, because hundreds of thousands of young Americans are running cross country. How can we ignore how high level these young athletes are? It stuns me, really, you know, and I think the running stores have done a good job. The coaches around the country, they don't get the respect they deserve. Those coaches, you give it to the football coaches. I know football. I watch it. I seen them. I always thought, you know, I always wanted to run a marathon against a relay team of football, the best football players. And you know, put 26 of them out there. I want to run against 26 of them.
Each run a mile. I love it.
Yeah. They're going to have to crack a sub 5-minute mile. Okay. I don't think they can do it. I'm just putting Bill Rogers' challenge out there, and we'll let some new young American marathoner take on the challenge.
Maybe. No, come on. Take him out at your age. In your late 50s now.
I think I could still beat him.
I love the idea.
You got to be a little bit cocky in this sport.
No, well, and I also think that, one of the stats that always sticks in my head is that I think back when you were running Boston, even though the field of the Boston Marathon in, let's say, late 70s, early 80s was, I don't know, what was it, 8,000 people maybe or so?
In 78, I think it was something like that. Maybe the biggest fields I raced were in New York. I won my last New York in 79. I think there were 15,000.
Yeah.
But to me, it was the competition. Who is my competition? You know?
Yeah.
But who am I racing? No.
But these field sizes are, you know, 3, 4, 5 times bigger now.
Yeah.
But the number of people running a sub 3-hour marathon has actually decreased, not just the percentage, but the raw number of people, because it used to be more of a race. It was competitive back, you know, in 78. People, you entered the Boston Marathon to run a race.
Sure.
And look, I'm all for, you know, not that I was ever going to win a race, but, you know, I'm all for middle of the pack, back of the pack people to get out and do that.
Yeah.
But I do think we've lost something on the competitive part of running somehow.
Well, I think we need both.
Yes.
I love it because I think our sports, highest level marathoners, track and field athletes, cross country runners can be role models for our population, just as football players and basketball players or baseball players can be. But we have to understand the sport a little better. We have to understand also what it means to really be fit and to really be healthy. You know, so I think we're coming to an understanding of that more and more, particularly these days when we're taking a look at the pandemic. What does it mean a little bit? You know, it's serious stuff. And so I love seeing, I don't care how slow you are, you had the courage to do that, to get out there and try to become an athlete. I do believe, you know, the world, we all should live as athletes and playing the sport you love. It doesn't matter which one it is. I do tend to lean towards the cardio sports, the Olympic sports of swimming, walking, you know, running, rowing, you know, the tough sports.
Right.
But the door is open to everybody. Cycling, you know, cycling used to be really big in America years ago. I want us to be really competitive in all these sports. You know, we are in some, we are in swimming. We're pretty decent in cycling. In track and field, we're the best in the world. You know, we got great sprinters, long jumpers. But I think I think for our population now, I don't think the healthcare leadership is tough. I don't think they're that tough. I think they can't match these kinds of athletes. I would like to see our healthcare will change. I'm looking to it. I'm looking to it to happen.
No, I hope so. No, and look, we have a childhood obesity epidemic in this country. And I mean, what simpler, better way to combat that than having kids go out for track and field or cross country?
Swimming. Michael Phelps. You don't have to be a Michael Phelps, but you can do it. Just, you know, that's why I like our sport, because the door is so open. You know, or if you want to be a walker, you just need to get out the door with your brother or sister or family or friend, your neighbor, you see them walking. One good thing that came out of the pandemic, I hate to say there was anything good about
it. Right.
As far as I'm concerned, it's all bad, hurt us. But, you know, I did see a lot of people out there, you know, dads and their sons and daughters on the bikes.
Absolutely.
And I love seeing people out there. And that's, I just hope that, you know, that healthcare in America can change in a positive way, where we can be prepared when we get hit with the next virus, and Americans are also healthier, and the struggle with obesity and being inactive. I just believe we're not treating our people right. And I know a lot of doctors who are runners, and a lot of them, they're really, really superb people. And we need more of that from our healthcare business world. That's what we need.
Well, look, I see it. We see it around our neighborhood too. You see, for the first time, you see families running together, which is great. And I'm always a little bit of an optimist, but I feel as if interest in running is kind of booming right now. And I think for next year's race season, you know, this year was a lost year for marathons and 10Ks and half marathons.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's so much pent up demand for next year.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You know,
I always have faith in, like Warren Buffett said, in America, the American people, I always have faith. But sometimes you got to push the levers a little bit, you know? And I think we really need to make changes now for your business, because that affects the American people's health. And we're not a healthy society. I mean, we're like 35th in the world. To me, we should be top 10. That's the way I like to think as a person. You know, that's the way I was as an athlete, and I'm just going to live that way. And I just believe political leadership hasn't treated the American people right.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I just feel that's true.
Now, so if you were, this is a really interesting thought, but if you were, that you're taking us down, if you were superintendent of the Boston public school system, what would your approach be to increasing the health and fitness of those kids?
You know, I was a teacher for,
I know,
of a sort for 3.5 years. I worked in special ed, never written Mass, and also in Waltham, Mass, the Fernald School. So I tried to get the kids outside.
Yeah.
Don't keep people locked up inside all day.
Yes.
And for the business world, that's stupid too.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
A healthier, an active person is going to be a better employee. They're happier. They're more focused. They got the energy. They got the drive. You know, it's just reality. And we see that, I think, more and more. I've met people in the business world who are runners and active athletically, and, or, you know, go to the gym. They stay really fit. And these are really tough-minded people. We need more of that. We need businesses that understand that all their employees count, and they need that time to get out the door for a walk or a run or a gym. I know a lot of companies have gyms in-house. I know TJ Maxx does here in Massachusetts. I know Pepsi has right. that at their headquarters. A lot of corporations do, and I love seeing that. That's what we need. That's what we need. We need that understanding, you know.
Well, and I love your point
for
about
the
getting
school kids. I'm in favor of. We've had some problems here in Massachusetts with the young people getting together and parties and all that sort of
right.
thing. You know, the young people have got to be tougher. They got to be tougher and walk the walk and race the race. You know, and think of their elderly family members.
True.
You know, that's what they got to do. But I think Mayor Walsh is on the ball guy. We have a great governor, Governor Baker. He's a tough guy. And so we will crack down a bit, you know, and beat the pandemic. This is what we got to do.
No, and I love your thought about just if the part of the answer is just get outside. If you're outside, good things are going to happen, right? If you're slouched at home, you know, I watch our poor kids doing Zoom classes for 7 hours a day. And, you know, it is soul sucking, man. You know, so, but, you know, I was talking to this teacher the other day, and she, now the kids are starting to go back to school in person. And she's a big believer in, she's an English teacher, big believer in having kids sit around in a circle to discuss a book or reading. And indoors, you can't really do that. You got to have all the tables have to be faced with it. And she said, nope, I don't care if you bring an old quilt to school or three old down jackets. We are going outside. I don't care what the weather is. We're going to sit. We're going to do our circle because the only place you can do the circle is outside. You can't do it inside. And she's like, I'm sticking to that. So, you know, button up. We got to do it.
You know, my partner, Karen, her son's married to a Boston school teacher, special needs kids. And, she, you know, trying to do a mixture of the, you know, teach from home and in the classes and everything. But I do agree, you know, the more you can have an understanding of nature and the real world, which is the outside world, it's good for everybody. But yeah, I believe in the world also of video games and have fun.
Yeah, sure.
Internet, you know, you got to do that. That's modern world technology and everything. I love that. But don't give up on yourself.
Yeah. That's so you mentioned toughness a couple times. So I'm really interested in the two parts of your personality because you got to be tough to go deep into the pink cave in the last 2 miles of a marathon and back in your peak training, you're doing 170 plus miles per week. I mean, that's just tough any way you slice it. And you're injured and hurt and sick. But how do you match that part of your personality with the part that you mentioned that was a conscientious objector and, you know, believe yeah. deeply in kind of peace and justice? How do you manage that toughness with being a really sympathetic soul at the same time?
Well, I think they are connected, I think, for everybody. And we all have that in us, you know. But I think it's what do you believe in, you know? And, you know, I had a black roommate when I was a freshman at Wesleyan. And I remember when Martin Luther King was killed, the black kids at Wesleyan all suddenly were sitting together and didn't want to hang out together with us white guys too much. And I said, right. Yeah, I totally got that, you know? And, so I think, you know, I was one of these people. I go to DC, I went to the Martin Luther King Monument, I went to the Lincoln Monument, you know, I read about his comments about the Vietnam War. I felt sadness, just sadness,
yeah.
You know, but running for me was just for fun. It was always just for fun. And if you have fun with running and you find that, and we can all find that, that's what I love. And yeah, there's the competition, but, and that's for fun too. And if you, right. what I love about our sport, you get beaten, you get crushed, or it's okay. You can always come back. Shake hands. If you're neck and neck with a runner, you shake hands with the guy who beat you, because that's our sport. We're like golf. You know, we're kind of a different kind of sport that way, I think. But I do think, man, this is a competitive sport. It's global. I think the two most competitive sports are soccer, which is all over the world.
Yes.
I want to see our men's team crank up even more. I'm going to support them. We got the revolution here in the Massachusetts area.
No, the women are okay. Our men need to step it up. I agree.
They're very good, but I don't think we don't give them the support.
Yeah, that is fair. Yeah.
I'd like to see soccer get more support in the U.S., you know, because I believe in global competition. Business, sports, you name it. The U.S. got to be there, you know? And so that's the way I think, you know, that's the way I am. But I'm not one of these people who, you know, I'm not going to knock the other guy down. You know, I'm not going to cheat to get ahead. I'm not going to take EPO. I'm going to train even, because when you train clean, you know, you're a good athlete. You're a really good athlete. You're still going to do well. It's you. It's who you are, you know. And I think most of the athletes today are clean, especially the Americans. But I still think our sport is the best in the world because everyone can get out the door.
Totally agree.
And you find yourself in a certain way. And you find, man, you feel so much better when you're active.
Oh, absolutely.
You feel better. You have more energy. And it doesn't matter your age. You know, I think you live better. I think you know, to have good health. That's what Ben Franklin said, Benjamin Franklin. He said, our health is our first wealth, should be our first wealth.
I haven't heard that he said. That's great. And then are you, so we caught up with Jeff a week or two ago. He was really generous and spent some time with us for this podcast, and it was a great conversation. But he, I liked his views on run, walk, run, right? So you can, and he, you know, he says you can get some real value out of a couple miles of walking interspersed with your running. But do you subscribe to that?
Absolutely. I'm a huge fan of walking. I think it's maybe the best sport of all, because that and swimming, because your injury rate is way down. Running, you can get injured if you really push it. You know, you start doing the marathon, it's tough, you know. But Jeff is such a different person. I was with him once out at Boston. He was writing a book about training for the Boston Marathon. So we go in this little shop, you know, to get a bite to eat. And next thing I know, he's talking to somebody, and I think they recognized me. And he said, "Oh, you won the Boston Marathon." And I said, "Yeah, and this is Jeff Galloway." And Jeff starts talking to this runner. Next thing you know, he's convincing this person they're going to run the marathon.
Love it.
Jeff Galloway. I mean, he's like, he's just got this gift.
Yeah.
He's got this gift, and he can convince anybody that, you know, "Oh, you like football? I'm going to get you to be a linebacker for the Pittsburgh Steelers." You know, he just can do it. It's just different. And most people can't do that. But I like Jeff's attitude. I like it that he believes in this.
Let's take care of ourselves.
Let's take care of ourselves.
No, absolutely. And it makes you feel a little bit less guilty. I mean, I want to move every day, right? But some days I'll sort of feel like, I think my body's telling me a long walk is better than a medium run. And
no, it's very true. And it's very hard to change, because, you know, we're really going through a time where I think we are changing as a country. I think Americans want better health. And I can see it by all the people who are out there on their bikes. My friend Jack Foltz, another Boston champion, he's become a cyclist last 20 years. Really fit guy. I mean, this guy is strong and healthy, and you just see all my fellow Americans out there, and I'm just stunned, and we just need to treat them with the respect the drivers and cyclists treat each other with the respect, and design the roads. They're doing that in Boston now, designing the roads wider,
yeah.
A cycling lane, doing that in New York, the bike paths being built all across the country. I love seeing that.
Yeah, it's a great thing.
I'm still going to a lot of the races I've gone to for many, many years, like out in Iowa at the Bix race. You know, when I first went there in 1980, there was no bike path along the Mississippi River. Now, when I go out there with Charlie and Joan Benoit Samuelson, we run on the bike path, and I see all these people out there. And it's fantastic. This is what we were all wishing to see years ago, and now it's happening. So it is happening. And I think we want to get even a higher level, you know, I think so.
Yeah. So going back to those 170 mile weeks, what did that look like? I mean, you probably weren't mixing a lot of walking in with those 170 miles, but what are those, 2-a-days, 3-a-days? Are you running 35 miles one day, 10 the next? What did that breakdown look like?
You know, when I was in high school, I didn't run that much. I ran probably maybe 20 miles a week, something like that. When I went to Wesleyan with Jeff Galloway and Andy Burford, they were already marathoners, these guys.
Okay.
I didn't really understand the marathon, but they took me out on longer runs. I did my first 15-mile run with Andy Burford, and that was tough.
Yeah.
I had to get used to it. I built up to it. But when I became a full-time marathoner, one thing was, you know, I was a teacher for a while. That was tough, because I would be invited to compete, let's say, in Japan at Fukuoka International Marathon or something, and they'd have to get a substitute teacher. You know, it's like that life we were living where we couldn't make a living, and we couldn't go try to compete internationally and represent the United States. We went through a tough time, and all of the Western world athletes did. But that all changed in 1980-81, you know, with the Association of Road Racing Athletes, when our sport put on a professional road race, and now we can have prize money, and we can live a more careful life, you know, and represent our country. So that happened. And I started training twice a day, because I remembered that's what Amy Burfoot did. We both had jobs in the kitchen at Wesleyan. We worked part-time.
Okay.
You know, and helped pay for the cost of schooling. And then Amy would go out and run before. He'd run 8 miles in the morning, then run another 8 or 10 in the afternoon. But so I started doing that too, you know, and my competition was doing that. I knew Frank Shorter had to be doing that, you know, took a gold medal, then another medal in Montreal and everything. So I started to read about, you know, track and field news. I've been a fan forever and ever, you know, so I learned about the sport, but I loved running and I had the energy. I was lucky. I always liked running on grass and everything. So
what does training look like now for you? So you're in your early 70s now, is that right?
Yeah, I'll be 73 this December. And so my training has, of course, changed every decade. I've been running now for 57 years, since 63.
Yeah.
Took about a year off, you know, during that time when I was kind of a lost runner or whatever, lost person.
Right, right.
And everything. And I've run about 185,000 miles in my life. I have a couple of friends who've done 200,000 miles.
Wow.
Yeah, they're really, you know, the nitty gritty. All right, we're extremists a little bit, but we're really not, you know. You know, most of my runs were at moderate pace. Sometimes I like to push it, you know, and with some of my training buddies from the old days, you know, with Greater Boston, some of them, you know, when you stop and you're looking for the bathroom in the woods, they would wait for you.
They'd
would
keep going.
So I'd have to really run hard for a couple of miles to catch up to them. But most of my running was pretty moderate. You know, I used to go on the track just once a week. I know a lot of the pros of
today, that's it.
They're on the track more. But I'll tell you something. And I never had surgery in my career. And I think I'm maybe the only high-level American marathoner or distance runner who's won the races I've won and succeeded the way I've run. I never had surgery. I did break a leg once. I broke my left tibia. You know, I was 55 years old.
Running?
Yeah, I was on a run and I broke my leg. I had low vitamin D. I think that was my issue. I read how Dina broke her toe in Beijing Olympic Marathon and discovered, you know, we both fight melanoma, skin cancer in our families. So we, I later went in for, you know, a blood test, found I was low in vitamin D. So I take a vitamin D supplement now.
Okay.
But nowadays, you know, in my 40s, I duked it out with Frank Shorter and, you know, Jim Ryan and Wilson Waigwa from Kenya and Henry Rono from Kenya, you know, as masters runners. So I set some American records in my 40s, my 50s. Tried to win won the Falmouth Road Race in my 60s and at age 70, my age group.
Right.
I still look at Pete, but I'm not a marathoner anymore.
No.
I retired years ago, actually after the 96 Boston, the 100th Boston. But I did run two more. I ran in 2009. I was trying to set the age 50 American record there. And then which I didn't make, I dropped out in the heat.
Okay.
And then I ran it in 2009 because I was hit with cancer, prostate cancer, in 2008. So I ran just to make my comeback sort of as a runner. And ran with a couple of my training buddies. You know, it was fun. It's just fun.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But today, as an older runner, it's tough. But I run with Karen, my partner there. We ran this morning, you know.
Great.
5 miles. Because there's nothing to aim for. Didn't do any speed work, no pickups, nothing like that. Longest, but I did do a half marathon with a doctor friend of mine, Dr. Rob Leitman. I work with him and his team, Team Daniel.
Okay.
And we, you know, I do it, or his race is usually a 5K. This year was a half marathon. He's a marathon. He's run like 90 marathons.
And, wow, okay.
So I ran the half with them. I can run a half pretty decent, you know. But I don't, you know, to run the marathon, because I did 60 marathons in my career. And I ran 28 sub-215s. That's a lot of hard training.
That's a lot, yeah. Yeah. And so we caught up a couple of weeks ago with a guy named Lynn Rathjen. Lynn lives in Nebraska. And he just set the world record. He's the first 75-year-old person ever to run a sub 6-minute mile. He ran a 5:59 mile about 2 months ago. But we'll plant that seed in your head. Six. So you get 2 more years, you'll be 75. And so if you had to go out and you know, or let's say we gave you 6 weeks to train, Could you get below a 6 minute mile now?
Oh my gosh. You know, for one thing, I don't have fast twitch muscle fibers. I discovered that even in high school.
Right.
I didn't know why I was getting beaten by these guys.
Yeah.
Later, I realized it was, I understood the science of training a bit better. I might duke it out with that guy in a half marathon now.
All right. We'll let. So two challenges. You and Lynn in a half marathon. We got to follow up on. And then I like your NFL run idea too. We'll pull 26 guys off the Patriots and have them each run a mile. I got my money on you.
Well, the money's got to be good. The money's got to be good.
Man.
Because it's good in football, and I don't want those guys to feel like I'm jerking on the money if I beat them. You know.
There you go. Get them. They got to buy 10,000 copies of the book. That'll put some food on the table.
You know what? I do want to say, you know, when I was younger, and I saw the older runners out there. One of our champion age 40 guys, when I was about 30 years old, he was a pastor, and I'm trying to think of his name now. Green.
Okay.
His name is Green, and last name is Green. And he said a lot of the American records is 50 or older. I always took my hat off to him because I also knew Johnny Kelly, you know, here in Boston.
And yeah, amazing guy.
Johnny Kelly. And I said, as a piece of work, I didn't understand him. Now I understand him, you know. But I love seeing, like I said, the American people or anyone from any country who says, you know, I'm going to keep going. I'm going to try. You know, everything is just give it a try.
Yeah.
Like that guy you mentioned, he's 75 years old. That guy has guts. I mean, he's got guts.
Oh, yeah.
We think it's the linebacker. There's that 75-year-old guy, too. You know what
Oh,
I mean?
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying it's here.
Absolutely. No, you got to be smart about it, too, right? He's not going to go out and do 80-mile weeks. That wouldn't work.
No, that guy would kill me in the mile.
Yeah.
Trust me.
All right. Well, keep it in mind. Keep an open mind. All right. Speaking of Johnny Kelly, here's my pet peeve. This is my only complaint about the Boston Marathon is that the Johnny Kelly statue is hidden by a bunch of shrubs and it's turned the wrong way. You got to call the city of Newton and get them to put the Johnny Kelly statue so it faces the course, right?
Yes.
All
Let's
right,
call
man.
The BAA and the city of Newton and get Johnny facing us. I love that. The runners will go crazy.
Well, so many people I've talked to said, somebody told me the Johnny Kelly statue was around mile 20 or whatever that is.
Yes.
And I never saw it. I was looking for it.
You know,
but
it was on the other, it was initially placed on the other side of the street. As you went up, we're starting to go up the hill there. It was placed across the street, but the town moved it. I don't know if it was in a way from traffic drivers a little bit, facing the other direction at that intersection, you know.
All right. Well, they're not going to listen to me. They're going to listen to Bill Rogers. So we'll follow up on that one. That's our. Hey, and I wanted to touch on something that I've always wondered about. If I have the numbers right, in late 74, November 74, you had your first marathon win. You won Philly. Mm-hmm. You ran New York, and shortly after that, New York went okay, not great, I think. And then you won Philly, and you ran 221.
Yeah.
And then 5 or 6 months later, you won your first Boston in April 75.
Yeah.
And you dropped from 221 to 209.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered about, you know, what do you attribute that amazing progress to over a pretty short amount of time?
You know, it actually took me 3 years to get down to 209. Because I, you know, I was a new marathoner in 73, was my first Boston when I dropped out. Then I ran another marathon in 73, and I was coached by Tom Dedarian, 219 marathoner, who's now coached at the Boston Track Club, and has written the history of the Boston Marathon, a great book.
Yes.
Definitely one of the books I would recommend to any of your listeners. If you want to really get a feel for what marathoning is about, for the lives of the people who gave their heart and soul to the Boston Marathon, over 100 and some years. It's just an incredible book. It's just, man, I'll knock you out. But I was learning the marathon. It took me a while to learn, you know, and you got to remember also how our sport has changed so much in the last 20 years in particular. When I ran my first New York City Marathon in 1974, it was actually September. It was 90 or 95 degrees. I wanted desperately to win that race. There was no money or anything. It was a trip to Olympia, Greece. the Olympics has always been a driving force for, I think, many people all over the world. It's
right.
Fantastic, idea. And I wanted to go to Olympia, Greece, see where the Olympics was born, in ancient times. And the New York City Marathon was sponsored by Olympia Airways. The first prize was a trip to Olympia, Greece. I went out like crazy. I'm going to win this race, running along, and I'm a half a mile ahead of the other runners. 21 miles comes, 90, 95 degrees. I don't care. It just knocked me out. I'm on the side of the road. Thankfully, a young guy named Art Hall, a member of the New York Roadrunners Club, knew me a little bit. I had run 219 at that stage. He had run about that fast.
Okay.
Yeah. He came over and he said, "Bill, you okay?" Because I was knocked out. And he gave me some water and helped me get going again. And I got back on my feet. And, he beat me that day. He was ahead of me, but I did finish. He helped me to finish. So it was like I kept all the marathoners. It was too hot. Sport leadership needed to change. So Fred LeBeau and the New York Roadrunners Club then moved the New York City Marathon to late October. And later they moved it a week later to make it even more cool weather. So what I'm saying is that our sport and all the runners in past years, the Johnny Kellys, the DeMars, whoever they were, people running all the way through till about the 80s or 90s. And many of the races were too hot, So that's what happened to me. I got beat up in a lot of marathons. But when I ran Philly, it was actually freezing cold rain. It was a tough day. Oh. So I just needed a good day. But over the 3 years and my training with my teammates, some really tough-minded teammates, and Bobby Hodge, Ray Thomas, and Billy Squires, we all succeeded. We all did. And yeah. So I had that day. The day in Boston, we had a tailwind. It was a tailwind day. And about once every 10 years, you will get a tailwind at Boston. You can really move, But so I had just won a bronze medal in World Cross Country. Only four American men have ever medaled in senior division world cross country. And I beat Frank Shorter, who had won our trial. I was fourth in our trial.
Okay.
Because I was coming off the flu. But I was psyched, at Boston. I knew I was fit from winning that medal. I got a pair of racing shoes from Steve Prefontaine.
Come on.
Courtesy of Jeff Galloway. I was with Nike. And I was so psyched, and seize the day,
and so
tailwind, you can't go
tailwind,
wrong.
Great weather. Obviously you're fit and feeling good. And did the crowd help you? Did the crowd know who you were at that point? Probably not really. Yeah, right.
I had Boston GBTC. My shirt, which I found, by the way, in a trash can somewhere, cause we were all poverty stricken. No runners. This is the way the sport was. We were winging it, we're totally winging it.
Yeah.
But so I got some yells from Boston and that sort of thing. But I got in the lead. When I got in the lead and Jack Semple was hanging out the bus, the leading bus, saying, "You're on the record. You can break the record." And
did that help to hear that crowds, or hurt?
No, it helped me.
It did. Great.
Yeah. And the crowds of Boston, man, fire. It's like, that's why Boston is Boston,
Absolutely. And who
it
was
everybody.
Who was challenging you coming down, for the last two or three miles?
Actually, I broke away halfway. So Jerome Drayton, the Canadian national marathon record holder for 40 years, he was for real, 2:10:08, at Fukuoka International Marathon.
Wow.
1975, he beat me there, a great runner, super nice guy, leader for Canada for so many years, but he didn't know who I was, and I was a new marathoner and all. He let me go. It's a good thing, as he was very, maybe he would have beaten me if he stayed with me, but he let me go. He probably feared I didn't know what I was doing, but it was a tailwind day, and someone yelled, "Go Canada." You had the maple leaf on,
Yeah.
And I said, no. And the course record it was held by England's Ron Hill. I said, no, I'm going for this thing. I had no idea what when I ran 2:09:55, I didn't believe the time. I thought though that I could run a 2:12 marathon. When I was a 2:19 guy, I said, I think I can run 2:12. It was just like, I just you know, I'm going to keep trying. You know, you keep trying in this sport, and lowering your time is a big part of our sport. But today, I think we've gone a little too far in the time side of it, because, you know, I love the quest, you know, the sub-2-hour thing. I love the quest and everything, like Bannister, the sub-4-minute mile. Sure. I love that part of our sport. That's what drives us all, in a way. What can I do? But right. But it also led, I think, maybe to the sometimes to the use of the drugs, you know.
Right.
Shoes and all that.
Yeah.
Your shoes were okay.
So you're cool with the carbon shoes? You don't have a problem with those?
Because that's always been the evolution of shoes. When you take a look, you know, if you go into the Boston Athletic Association headquarters, you see the shoes that the young Japanese guy won Boston in 1954, and the shoes that Johnny Miles won Boston in way, way back in the 1920s, 1926. These shoes were, they were terrible. Yeah. They're terrible. And so, yeah. So the companies all compete. This is part of competition. And you make shoes to help your athletes sell. Yes, they have to be certain parameters, and it's true whether you're a sprinter. They had some shoes, they had the band there, you know, the brush shoes of years ago. But I think they have worked the technology out pretty well now so that you don't gain too much. And for some people, perhaps those shoes don't work well. You know, well, I think that's a big, big issue.
I think it also brings some excitement to the sport. And if people you know, are talking about $250 shoes that make you run 4% faster, hey, that's great. And it's interesting. Brings
running I think so news. Too. It's technology.
Yeah.
Technology and helping you run better. And if, give it a try. You know, some of my friends are trying those shoes and really, really like them. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
And so that was, so 75, amazing moment of your life. Was that the, I'm going to go see Tommy Leonard for a Blue Whale. Was that year that when you said that, or was that later on?
Yeah, that was when Tommy Leonard, the founder of the Falmouth Road Race, one of America's great, great road races.
Legendary guy, yeah.
Yeah, bartender, Marine, really a cool dude, Boston Marathoner, former Greater Boston Track Club. Remember, you know, we all hung out at the Elliott Lounge. You know, most pubs you walk in and there's hockey guys there or basketball, football, right. Whatever.
Boxers.
You walk in here and there's Frank Shorter winning the gold in the Munich Olympic Games, you know, or Joan Benoit Samuelson, you know, taking the gold, you know. And this,
that's what he had. He had that hanging on the wall of the bar, right? Pictures of great runners.
Yeah, because he's a Boston dude.
Yeah.
You know, he's from Massachusetts. And
I love it. So that was an amazing moment. And then obviously later, you know, you had the three straight Boston wins, but talk to us about the 76 Olympics. Were you disappointed with that, or was it just a great life experience? You know, Frank had won in 72. Americans are probably sky high expectations going into it. You just set an American record in the marathon in 75. So how did that go in, that was Montreal, yeah. 76.
You know, when I ran the trials with Frank, I knew I could run with Frank because I had beat him in the world cross country champs by a minute. You know,
right.
I thought I could race, you know, in the marathon too. And I had run 2:09:55. He was a 2:10 guy, Fukuoka, which by the way is a very four wheel marathon. It's an up and back marathon and all that. It's in four wheel and with a lot of history. And so I knew Frank. But what happened was I hurt my foot going into Montreal. So I had a foot injury in the metatarsalgia, you know, where your shoes are a little too tight in the forefoot, you know, and I was a high mileage runner, running 100, 130 miles a week, something like that, training twice a day. I overdid it a little. You get hurt a little. So I was apprehensive at Montreal. I really was. And, you know, Don Cardon beat me at the Peachtree Road Race, another America's great road races, but
absolutely.
I beat Don in the Olympic trials marathon, but he was also a good 10K guy. But at the Olympics, Don showed his ability and Frank showed his again. And I just fell apart, you know, after about halfway. I think partly the injury, I stopped doing speed work because of that. And so it was a crushing blow. It knocked me down. I mean, I remember looking at the stadium afterwards. I limped in, you know, I was going to finish no matter what, because the Olympic Games. And And I saw it said, see you in Moscow, 1980. Kind of tough because, you know, 40 years ago, this winter, we thought we were aiming for the Olympics, but of course the boycott came on the scene. And it's almost like, I almost feel that now, the young athletes of today, you know, want to go to the Olympic Games, you know, Molly Seidel, Molly Huddle, all our athletes, all our great athletes, you know, but it was taken away. So I don't know, it was tricky, but you know,
well, no, and I, look, I understand why we did the boycott, but I, you know, you may disagree. My personal view is it's important no matter what's going on in the world, whether people are at war or peace or anywhere in between, that you come together, you put differences aside for those 3 or 4 weeks. It's disappointing to me. And you were at that point, 1980, you were really in peak form, right?
Well, I think I would have done better placing than 40th place if I made the team. You know, Benji Durden, Kyle Hefner, and Tony Sandoval, who made the team in 1980, were all for real. You know, no drugs, just some really hard training athletes. Also, by the way, I read a great book about the boycott. It's really interesting, and about President Carter's efforts to initiate the boycott with other countries around the world. And it was, you know, Seiko from Japan got knocked out. He had a great shot to win the Olympic gold. I think I would have been top 10. I beat Moseya from Soviet Union at the time at Fukuoka. He took fifth place in Moscow. But you know, I'm one of these people who, I love the Olympic Games, but it's not everything. Yeah. And I do think that it brings the world together, and we got to think that everyone should think that way. But what happened to me was I got invited to a little race out in Iowa in 1980 called the Big 7 Miler. They brought me back to that race every year for 40 years.
Oh, great.
So it was like lemonade was made out of lemons, you know, and I still love the Olympic Games, you know, I love them, and I'm going to be cheering for our team, you know, in Tokyo. And I hope that the pandemic, we can bring it down worldwide.
Oh, I know.
The world celebrates again.
Well, and you mentioned it, some of our younger runners, and do they reach out to you? You probably see them at races or at marathon expos. Do they seek your advice and perspective?
You know, it depends what you mean by young. A lot of the younger runners, they don't know me or Frank Schroeder or something. Yeah, you know,
maybe it's true.
The hand of Father Time, I think, is for real. But, you know, as someone who always studied our history, I know who Tracy Smith is, for example. Most young cross-country runners don't know who he is, but he took a world cross-country bronze medal as well, as I did, you know, cross-country. So I always followed it. I know who Bob Scholl is, our Olympic 5,000-meter gold medalist. I know who Billy Mills is, you know, things like that. And I know the women's side of the sport as well, is because I still – you know, I'm pretty fanatical about the sport, I guess you could say. But
good.
But I was going to go to a cross-country meet with 3,000 runners in Ohio this year, put on by a friend of mine, a coach in Ohio named Ted Rue, good runner too. And but last minute they couldn't do it because of the pandemic. You know, but I go to a running camp out in Indiana, over running camp, and it's just fantastic because you've got all these young kids coming in from all over the country, and they teach the kids more about just sports. You know what I'm saying?
It's absolutely.
Like what our sport stands for, the health and fitness side, but also, you know, good sportsmanship type attitude or feeling. And Joe Benoit Samson is going to be there. Jacqueline Hansen, Boston Marathon winner, former world record holder in the marathon, is going to be there. She goes every year. They bring in all these young coaches from around the country. I love seeing that. So this is the great part of our sport. But, you know, I always think, well, the young athletes can learn a lot there, but I don't know. It's fun. I'm always an optimist, no matter what, because you have to be.
No, it's the only way to live life, right? I totally agree. Hey, you've been so generous with your time. We're not going to eat up too much more of your day, but I want to hit you with a couple really quick questions we've done with a couple other guests that we've kind of had some fun with. But so we'll hit you with a couple quick questions here. But we'll start with, what's your favorite movie of all time?
My favorite movie of all time?
Yes.
Well, my dad liked The Wizard of Oz. He grew up with that. My mom and dad still like that. You know, that's one of my favorites, of course.
How can you beat that? That's amazing. All right. Favorite book of all time, other than Marathon Man, your own book?
I like A Prayer for Owen Meany.
Oh, what a cool book. Yeah.
Yep. I like that a lot. I don't know other ones. I'm reading a book now about the Korean War and the Chosin Reservoir and everything, you know. It's really interesting. And
not the one about the pilots in the Korean War.
Ghost soldiers, about the ghost soldiers.
Oh man, that's a great one. Yeah.
Trying to rescue the Americans who were captives, in Japan, World War II and everything. Tough stuff.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. Okay. That's good. If you could have dinner with one person, dead or alive, who would you love to have dinner with that you haven't had dinner with already?
Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, that's a great pick. These days, are you a morning runner or afternoon or evening runner?
I'm definitely not a morning runner.
You got dragged out against your will this morning.
Yeah, my Karen's tough. My partner, Karen, she is 3 times tougher than me, 10 times tougher than me. Yeah, I am definitely not a tough-minded runner. I'm not. I just love running.
Wow, but you're being modest. Do you like running?
You know who's a tough-minded runner also is Joan Benoit Samuelson.
Oh, yeah.
That's how she got that gold medal. But Joan, she's up early. She's out training. She's cross-training. You know, but I wasn't one of those people, you know, a little bit different. But we're all different. We all have our different focus. Right. Our love, how we find the sport, and what and why we want to be there, you know?
Well, look, I love all these New England runners that we've mentioned today that have, you know, have to train through our sloppy, wet, freezing winters. builds character, right? But, you know, some amazing runners have grown up and trained throughout the year in New England, so.
I think it's very true. And I think the Olympians of today are training all at altitude, I think, you know? And I think that's so smart. Because you're going up against all two-born athletes, you know, so you gotta try to even the field as much as you can, and no matter who you are, you know. But I've met a lot of the younger runners, like Abdi. I've met Abdi; he's a good guy. I met Dina Castor. You know, I think her as a younger runner, she's only 40 or something like that. Shalane, you know, I raced against Shalane's dad. He was one tough runner.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah, he was a miler. He 800 meter guy. He was at UConn, University of Connecticut. So he beat me in those events, you know.
They're from Marblehead, I think, right? Marblehead, yes. Mass. Yeah.
Yeah. So I met some of the younger runners here and there.
That's all right. Last, two questions for you. Do you run with music or headphones or not?
I love music. You know, my dad was a piano player. He's big in my family and everything. And he was a jazz guy. I like all kinds of music, you know. But, I don't run with the earphones. I'm not good enough with technology. It would confuse me.
Good for you. No, I'm the same way. It's a good time to clear your head anyway. All right, last question. But most important mentor to you through your life?
Mom and dad.
Oh, they raised you right. Good answer. Parents. Good answer. Hey, we can't thank you enough, Bill. You're so we've got 10 hours more questions for you, but we might hit you up for another 2.0 session here at some point. But this is great stuff. No, I love the history and the philosophy. We've covered a lot of ground, and you're so nice to share your time with us. And
I love it. I love what you're doing.
Well, because thank you.
We want to reach out because a lot of runners they don't have coach and they're making mistakes. So the more you can do these interviews,
absolutely.
Meb or Abdi or Shalane or anyone, the professional runners can help the newer runners who are coming up, because that's what it was like for me. You know, Tom Dedarian helped me, Coach Billy Squires, I had a lot of help. Everyone had help. Shalane had help. You know, her mom and dad were both runners. Everyone. So I think that's the history of our sport, really. And this is such a tough sport sometimes. It can be so tedious and mentally and physically fatiguing. So we have to find, how do we find a way around it? One is, you mentioned music, you know, and the other is, you know, how you live and what motivates you, you know, the food that motivates you, the movies that motivate you. You know, what are the other things in your life? Is it art, or what is it that drives you, you know?
Right, right. Okay. Love it.
So you're a journalist, you know, you guys are journalists. So key.
No, it's a passion of ours. And you know, another passion is running. So to get to marry those is a blast. So we're really lucky. Well, good stuff, Bill. Hey, we'll follow up again soon. And thank you so much again.
Let's stay in touch.